What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Patent cases are big business, with hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. A few entrepreneurial judges have made two pretty small Texas cities havens for these lucrative cases. But is that a good thing?
And just out of shot on the sets of Apocalypse Now, Eleanor Coppola was capturing the chaos behind her husband's production. Her award-winning film and her book detailed how it all so nearly came undone. But first,
doing the victory dance tonight, Nelson Mandela. The elections
a little more than 30 years ago, Nelson Mandela and millions of other black South Africans voted for the first time.
And joy that we can loudly proclaim from the rooftops, free at last.
And 3 decades on, South Africa is undeniably free, and vibrantly so. The evil of apartheid is long gone, there's a liberal constitution that protects people's freedoms, and there's much more socializing across racial divides than there ever was before.
John McDermott is our chief Africa correspondent.
But for many South Africans, they feel locked out of the democratic era, and this year they'll be going to the polls in a despondent mood.
What are they celebrating the democracy? It's 30 years after. Still feels like it's a struggle.
We've been let down. Okay, I actually have been let down, and I know I'm not going to vote for corruption.
Many of us are poor, so we're looking for change.
The mighty African National Congress, the party of Mandela, or the ANC, will struggle to maintain its majority for the first time since 1994. But there's also something else that's hanging over that election. It's a deeper question, one that goes to the heart of the future of South Africa, which is when so many people are excluded from the dividends of democracy, how can Mandela's South Africa survive? And to answer that question, I raked through a whole lot of data on South African attitudes and combined it with a trip through Mandela land, areas that were of biographical importance to him, but also indicative of how South Africans are feeling today.
So before we get to your trip through Mandela land, tell me about that notion that people are in a despondent mood ahead of this election.
Every opinion poll is pretty grim reading. If you ask people in South Africa, do you think your life will get better over the next 5 years? Less than a third say that, and that's the lowest share on record. Or if you ask them, are you satisfied with democracy? Then most people will say no. Again, record lows. And interestingly, there's something of a paradox, which is that although there's more socializing and integration across racial lines, the share of South Africans saying that they believe race relations have improved since 1994 has actually declined since around 2010. Perhaps most shockingly of all, 30 years after there were scenes of hundreds upon hundreds of Black South Africans snaking around polling stations waiting to vote, around 3/4 of South Africans today say that they would give up on elections if an autocratic leader could at least provide some jobs, security, and housing. So there's a real flimsiness to democracy in the Rainbow Nation.
It sounds like the disillusionment with democracy is really disillusionment with the economic situation.
I think that's right. Zooming out a bit, the democratic era can be seen in two halves. The first 15 years were generally pretty good. Pretty much every South African saw a material improvement in their life. growth ticked along at over 3%. The ANC governments built up basic welfare state. They constructed millions of houses. They took the edge off grinding poverty for a lot of pensioners through a social grant. And unemployment even started to tick down in the end of the 2000s. But in the last 15 years, there's been so much stasis. And in many cases, things have gone in reverse. So GDP per capita is no higher today than it was in 2008. Unemployment has gone from bumbling around at the 20% mark to more than 30%. And any community that you go to will tell you about how poor the infrastructure is. So when I was in Kunu, a rural area where Mandela spent his childhood, residents there were telling me that they hadn't had water for 4 years.
From 1994 up to now, there are too many changes, positive and negative. Mostly negative are dominating.
No jobs, you are here, there's no water, sometimes don't have electricity. We just have randomly power outage, you know. So I think currently there's a lot that's not right.
And this is so sad and so poignant because actually the provision of water as well as electricity in the early years of the democratic era was such a sign that things were getting better. But now, because of a combination of crime and corruption at a local level, the very fabric that seemed to be being stitched together in those early years seems to be coming apart. And that's why people are angry.
All of that makes sense for a generation who knew what things were like before, but there's a whole generation born since then.
Right, the so-called born free generation that came after 1994. And I think they are particularly despondent for a couple of reasons. One is that they bear the brunt of the unemployment crisis. I mean, pretty much half of 15 to 34-year-olds, and certainly around half of 15 to 34 Black South Africans are unemployed. And they also have a different frame of reference. So whenever I've spoken to older South Africans, especially in rural areas, this is the base of the ANC, they might say something like, oh, crime is quite high, life is tough, but I'm more personally free and I have a pension. But if you're a 25-year-old or a 35-year-old living in a place like Soweto or Ananda, then you don't have a lived experience of apartheid as a benchmark. You just have the huge expectations that came with 1994 and the sense that they haven't been met.
I don't think I'm going to vote this year. You know, see the youth is unemployed. You know, there's no jobs, the schools, the education is too high. There's no access to information.
Also, we have the negative things that are happening here, like, for instance, drugs, theft and alcohol abuse. Unemployment rate is very high. So
my experience is that there's just a deep frustration with being unable to kind of get on as an adult if you are a young South African. You want a job, you want a house, but the economy is just not providing it for you, nor is the education system. I went to the school in Kunu where Mandela was christened Nelson by an English teacher, and it was heartbreaking. There's a Mandela library that was closed because the roof had collapsed. Then you speak to the teachers, and they point out that just last year, there was a flashy Mandela museum built by the ANC government on the top of the hill. But they don't even have running water, and the kids aren't eating their school meals because the provincial government hasn't funded them. This is Mandela's school. So if you imagine the symbolic value of that, what must it be like elsewhere in rural areas?
The picture that you're painting, John, is kind of stark here, though. And when we've spoken to you in the past about the fortunes of South Africans, you've spoken of a rising middle class. Surely that plays into this whole big picture.
Yeah, there's definitely been a rise. Black South Africans make up about 2/3 of the overall middle class. So that's a bit less than their share of the population, 4/5. But certainly a big jump from 1994. And that has meant in workplaces and educational settings, there's much more mixing, at least at this stratum, between Blacks and whites. But the integration has only gone so far. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that, of course, most Blacks remain poor in one way or another. But also because I think there's a lot that's lost in translation between Black South Africa and white South Africa.
I was there hoping that, you know what, there's a Black female, you know, legal degree and all that, things are going to happen. it did not happen for me. So it caused a whole lot of frustration for me.
But we should all be the same in terms of water that we drink from the tap, services that are being delivered to us. We should go to the same shop. We should all not just go, but we should all afford to go to these places.
If you speak to people in the black middle class, they'll talk about how they've only had one generation of making good money, whereas white South Africans have had many. They'll also mention this thing called the black tax, which is a custom, partly a product of high unemployment, whereby they give a lot of their pay out to relatives. Meanwhile, white South Africans, if you look at surveys, they increasingly see problems with a lot of the race-focused economic policy of the ANC, whether that's around affirmative action or policies to redistribute wealth to black people, such as black economic empowerment. So they will often mention how they see the system as being unfair because it deliberately favors black people in the workplace. I was speaking to a researcher recently, and she put it this way. She said, black South Africans and white South Africans are having a conversation about the same thing, but from different perspectives. And that same thing is economic exclusion. Ultimately, as long as the economy is in a bad state, there'll be this sense that economics is zero sum, and therefore politics is also zero sum.
So what does that mean then for the coming election? What's going to happen with the ruling ANC?
The ANC will have its worst election result since 1994. It will almost certainly lose its national majority, probably get around 45% of the vote, according to recent polls. One might ask, why isn't it doing worse? And I think the answer to that is because there are a lot of South Africans who remember apartheid. There are South Africans who value the welfare state that the ANC's built up. But also, they feel like there's no good alternative. And I think for me, that is the real sadness of South African politics at the moment. There seems to be a kind of widespread failure of imagination. What I worry about going forward into the next 30 years is that if material circumstances remain so bleak, that opens the door to a lot of potentially ugly populism. But there's still a reason to be hopeful, and that's because what happened in 1994 has left a powerful legacy. Mandela left South Africa a vibrant democracy where there are norms around pragmatism and consensus. And that isn't going to go away anytime soon.
John, I look forward to talking to you more about this as the election draws nearer. For now, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Jason.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
Texas. You might know the American state for its cowboys, rodeos, country music, or even maybe for being home to NASA. So why are teams of lawyers representing the likes of Google and Intel descending on a pair of small Texan cities? Waco is the state's 24th largest city, with just 140,000 people. Marshall, some 200 miles to the northeast, is joint's 138th largest, with a population of just 24,000. But they've both become unlikely centers of patent law.
The reason that Waco and Marshall are on the map in intellectual property litigation is really because of some enterprising judges.
Annie Crable is The Economist's U.S. News Desk editor.
A lot of lawyers told me that patent lawsuits are not the kinds of cases that most judges love to handle. What patent lawsuits basically are is when one company or individual claims that another has violated a patent that it owns, so an innovation that it has registered the rights to. When these judges signaled that they actually wanted these cases, it really worked. And these unlikely cities in Texas really saw a major spike in patent litigation.
You'd picture top lawyers wrangling over these cases in major tech hubs like San Francisco or in Texas cities like Houston or Austin or maybe Dallas. But how did these savvy judges make these two fairly small cities centers of patent law?
It really starts out in Marshall. There was a judge named T. John Ward. He was appointed to the bench in 1999, and he had worked on only one patent case before, and he learned about these local rules that were being used in Northern California. Patent cases are really complicated, and judges have to make a lot of important calls along the way about technical matters, and they can also just drag out for years. So Judge Ward thought that these rules gave a bit of structure to these cases. He took those rules and he tweaked them to prioritize speed. Soon, litigants were getting to trial in Texas in half the time it took in California. And by the middle of the 2010s, T. John Ward's successor in Marshall had about a quarter of the country's patent cases. Fast forward to 2019, and a new federal judge in Waco named Alan Albright gave a presentation to a bunch of intellectual property lawyers. And his pitch was about why lawyers should file their next patent lawsuits in Waco, where he is the only judge. And he had adopted similar local rules to the ones that Marshall had. By 2021, Judge Albright had 23% of the country's patent cases, according to Lex Machina, which is a legal analytics firm.
So lots of cases presumably mean lots more people coming to the area. So what effect does that have on a fairly small city like Marshall?
Yeah, Waco's a bit bigger. There's a university there. But the mayor told me that the business that lawyers bring is still, quote, meaningful. In Marshall, you really do see an effect downtown. It helps catering companies and restaurants and coffee shops. And there are some funny examples from over the years. So one hotel bought a subscription to Pacer, which is an online court tracker to kind of monitor potential clients. Samsung, which gets sued a lot in Marshall, sponsored an ice rink across from the courthouse. And TiVo spent $10,000 on a grand champion steer and named it TiVo. The optics of this have sat uneasily with some people. Courts are not really meant to power their local economies or to be so specialized.
What has this meant in practice for cases being filed there?
Marshall, in particular, has a reputation for being plaintiff-friendly, and defendants often try to transfer their cases out. But that's partly because defendants, which are often big tech companies, can afford to drag out litigation. And plaintiffs often cannot, so they really like the speedy tempo. Patent lawsuits, for the most part, used to be able to be filed wherever the patent was being infringed. But in 2017, the Supreme Court effectively made it harder for plaintiffs to file lawsuits in Marshall. They required defendants to have, quote, regular and established businesses where they are sued. So Apple pretty quickly shut down its nearby stores. Samsung, the company that sponsored the ice rink, did not. And it continues to be sued in Marshall, where it was hit with a $303 million jury verdict last year.
And how about Waco? How has Waco fared?
A couple of senators wrote a letter in 2021 to John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And they wrote about the extreme concentration of patent litigation in Waco. And Chief Justice Roberts acknowledged this concern in his year-end report, which was pretty notable. So there was a rule change. So starting in 2022, basically Judge Albright lost his control over patent cases in Waco. They're now required to be put into a lottery so that any of the bigger districts, the Western District of Texas's 12 judges, could possibly draw them. In 2023, you know, fewer patent cases were actually filed overall, but Waco in particular saw a steep drop-off.
Okay, so what does the future hold for patent litigation?
People I spoke to point to Delaware, which already sees a lot of patent litigation. It's where a lot of businesses are incorporated, and it has really experienced judges. the Western District of Texas, which is also where Waco is, will probably still see some because Austin, Texas is a major and growing tech hub. But one thing I was curious about is the argument that patent litigation could reasonably warrant a specialized court. One legal expert I spoke to says that there are compelling reasons why Congress might think it would be wise to create a national patent court. But he emphasized that that's for Congress to decide.
Annie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Ori.
At one point, he fainted, he had a collapse, and he told me that he could see himself going down a dark tunnel, and he didn't know if he was dying or leaving this reality or what was happening to him. But he'd gone to the threshold, maybe of his sanity or something.
Eleanor Coppola faced plenty of disasters when she was working on the set of Apocalypse Now.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
A helicopter landed one day so close to her that it blew smoke and dust all over her and actually lifted her and the tripod right off the ground. Another time she was walking through a paddy field and found the camera being sucked under into the mud. There was often so much smoke about that she really couldn't get any view of the set at all and found herself just crying with the irritation of it. Then there was to be a burning of four peasant huts, and the special effects people set the fire around the huts, but it got completely out of control and moved to the paint room and the prop store where she kept all her cameras and her gear. So it was, in one way or another, a pretty grueling session for her. But she was so delighted to be working at all on the set of this film that she really took it all in her stride. The maker of the film, of course, was her husband, Francis Ford Coppola. It was his film, but in a way it was also hers. He was telling the story of Captain Ben Willard, who in the Vietnam War was sent to go up country to find a Green Beret Colonel Kurtz who had gone rogue and was running an operation that had to be shut down. He was doing so with enormous amounts of money, extras, gasoline, and also armaments that he quickly borrowed from the Philippines government and which were just as quickly snatched back again, including the helicopters, which didn't always turn up in the right numbers or with any trained pilots. So Frances was doing that, and she, his wife, was actually tasked with recording the making of the film. It was wanted for a promotional video. And so that was her job to do. She only had a single-lens camera, and she tended to loiter in the background and just try to make herself not conspicuous, but record all the disasters that were going on, such as typhoons and winds and loss of equipment and personality clashes between Francis and the people who he'd tried to cast. In the end, his film was nominated for 8 Oscars and won 2, and her film, it was called Hearts of Darkness, was nominated for 6 Oscars and won an Emmy.
My film is not a movie. My film is not about Vietnam.
C'est pas le sujet de Vietnam.
It is Vietnam.
C'est Vietnam.
It's what it was really like. It was crazy.
It was by far the finest piece of work and the longest piece of work she'd ever managed to produce. And that was high time, because she had strong artistic instincts and never really been allowed to express them. Somewhere in her cupboards, she had equipment from all the things she had tried, like carving plastic statues and doing fabric collage and doing a series of drawings. She had all the equipment to do these things. Her notes from the shoot of the film showed how keenly she noticed the patterns of beauty in everything, in flowers, in leaves, in the light that came through mats and fronds of trees, the lines of fish traps in a river. She had an artist's eye. But the trouble all the time was that she felt she shouldn't indulge it because her first priority had to be Francis and the three children. Francis, after all, came from an Italian family. For generations, the men had decided that the women should keep to the kitchen and the house and not do anything else. But when it came to Apocalypse Now in 1976, for the first time, she felt she was both helping him and indulging her own artistic talents. It also suited her character because she was, by nature, an observer. She tended to be very shy and to linger in the background and simply watch. And that was ideal where her job was, to record what she saw. So it's on Hearts of Darkness that you'll see Francis and Marlon Brando, who was cast as Colonel Kurtz, arguing about how the character was meant to be. Because Brando, who was charging $2 million for a month's work, and in the end it was only 3 weeks' work, had not read the Joseph Conrad novel. So he had no idea, really, who the character was, and he hadn't lost weight, as he had promised, in order to look like Kurtz. Also, there were other crazy conversations between Francis and Dennis Hopper, who played a paparazzo. Hopper was so stoned most of the time that he couldn't learn his lines at all and had to improvise them, so that was another difficulty. An actor who was a real joy, by contrast, was Martin Sheen, who played Captain Willard. But even he was felled by a heart attack. There was just no end of trouble with this film. She herself, when she got older, began to make feature films just to see if she could do it. They didn't win very much critical acclaim. Her main artistic endeavour in those years was an installation called Circle of Memory, which she made in memory of her son Gio, her eldest, who was killed in a freak boating accident when he was 22. And it was a circular building made of straw bales that were plastered over. And people were invited to come into this tomb, as it appeared to be, and to walk to a circular room in the middle where they could reflect and write notes about loved ones that they'd lost. Straw bales were very humble, and they were often overlooked. But she could still leave searing notes between the cracks.
Anne Rowe on Eleanor Coppola, who's died aged 87. On our website and our app, you can watch Anne explaining how she goes about choosing and writing her obituaries. It's part of a carousel of short explainer-style videos we've just launched. We'll add a new one every day. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.